Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nani Oxford.
Hello, how are you doing, Kat?
I'm doing wonderfully. It's the week of Pokemon! Pokemon week!
Yay! I feel very old, but I'm very excited, too.
Pika Pika.
Pika Pika.
We have a lot planned this week. We have a look back on Pokemania that took over the U.S. in 1998. Nadia, do you remember where you were when you discovered Pokemania?
Yes, I do, actually. I actually brought a toy Pikachu that my then-fiancé, now-husband, like, bought for me. And nobody knew what the hell this thing was. This little yellow rat toy that I was showing everyone. They're like, what is this? Like, Pokemon had not yet quite taken off. I showed them, like, hey, it says Pikachu, right? And then, like, my friend's like, why is this rat saying Kick-a-Jew? But, no, Pokemania took off proper in that summer when I was working at an amusement park at Canada's Wonderland, it was called. And I was part of the, quote-unquote, ecology staff, a.k.a. janitors, and we just all had these Game Boys and we were all playing Pokemon. And since I worked in the kids section of the park, like, they had the poker app going like 24/7 on the EPA.
Sounds like hell.
Yeah, it kind of was.
Yeah, I remember the first time I ever heard of Pokemon, I remember hearing that Pokemon is coming. It's this huge game, Pocket Monsters. It's incredible. And I thought, Pocket Monsters? Well, who gives a crap about Monster in my pocket?
Monsters in my
Why
pocket,
is everybody
yes.
going gaga for Monster in my pocket?
Monsters in my pocket.
Yeah, and I remember catching the first an episode of the anime because it had debuted here. It had a debut on TV, and if I recall correctly, it was the battle on the Saint Anne or the SSN or whatever.
Oh, iconic!
Yes, it was an iconic episode, and I remember being. I had no idea what the heck was going on, but I was amused by it.
A funny thing, I actually remember Canada got some of the episodes that were cut in the States. Like, I distinctly remember the episode where the shopkeeper pointed a shotgun at Ash, and that was an episode with Dratini in it.
Yes, back when kids' shows could have guns in them, but yeah. I don't know. I don't remember, like, particularly liking the anime, but I apparently liked it enough to ask for it for Christmas.
Aww.
And it changed my life.
Aww.
No joke. Yeah, so you should go check out the site. We're going to have a lot of coverage about Pokemon throughout the rest of the week. And we're actually going to be doing a thing here on the podcast. I don't think it's particular spoilers to say that this week's top 25 RPG entry is a Pokemon game. Which Pokemon?
Oops,
it's probably
Pokemon.
In the title, so... Yes, exactly. Who is that Pokemon? But first, Nadia, there was some interesting news last week.
Uh-huh.
Another retro console is coming. It's not from Nintendo.
Right, yeah, no, it's... it is a PlayStation Classic. And it's funny, the way I actually found out that this was happening, because I was off that day... was someone posted on their Facebook a picture of a PlayStation Classic and said, like, hey, Nintendo, can I borrow your homework? Okay, yeah, but just change it a bit to make it look like it's not yours and it's not mine. So that's how I learned about the PlayStation Classic.
Yeah. And so this is, I mean, it's pretty much the same as the NES Classic. They have announced, I believe, two RPGs so far.
Yes.
One of them is Final Fantasy VII, and the other one is...
Wild Arms, and I am excited about that because I love Wild Arms, although I am eager to see what people think of it in the here and the now, because it's not the best looking RPG. It never was, and it still isn't.
You are a huge Wild Arms proponent.
I am.
I think most people only know Wild Arms from its super boss opening cutscene.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to explain why it's so awesome?
It's a very, I will admit, it's a very retro RPG, very turn-based. I think even a little more archaic than Final Fantasy VII was. Certainly didn't look as exciting as Final Fantasy VII at the time. But it's a very unique setting where...
very unique.
It's a Western planet called Filgaea. And basically, it's dying. Like, the planet is experiencing rapid desertification, which, now that I think back on it, is Phantasy Star IV's premise, but... this isn't very sci-fi. This is very Western, where like the hero walks around with a gun, and that actually kind of makes him taboo, because guns are considered taboo because there was like a war against metal demons. It's a very anime slash Western mix, and I find that extremely interesting. And actually, there is quite an element of sci-fi in there. Now that I think about it, there's like an alien race. It's one of those games you play it, and you never really forget it.
I remember the opening cutscene is mostly what sticks with me, because you get that amazing, that whistling Western song with beautiful animation. And of course, this is a very new thing to video games at the time, the opening cutscene, right?
That's actually something I wrote about in, I forget what I was writing about in particular, I think just PlayStation nostalgia in general, saying how back then games had like these beautiful anime cutscenes, not only because they were like new and exciting, but because they served as the perfect capture mode for game stores back in the day, when games like weren't prescribed, hey, you have to run this CD of our corporate footage for infinity. Instead, they would choose a game and they'd put it like on their store monitor, or put it like, you know, in the window. And I remember one computer store in Toronto put up Wild Arms, so they had that intro, that beautiful anime intro going, and that just made a real impression on me.
You could tell that the developers were still new to the whole concept of polygons and 3D graphics and that kind of thing, because this game, on the face of it, for most of it, looks like a 16-bit RPG.
Yes.
The exploration is all in traditional sprite base, and the sprites are pretty good.
Yeah.
At least that's what I remember.
Yeah, the sprites are very
nice. It has a really good soundtrack, too.
Oh, it has an amazing soundtrack. I still listen to it.
Yeah, it has a phenomenal soundtrack. And then when you're in the actual battles, it shifts to some really ugly polygons.
The polygons are so... And not only that, the enemies all like share like 3 polygons each, maybe. And what's really kind of unfortunate is you have guardian summons in the game, which are very much like summons in Final Fantasy games, except Final Fantasy VII's summons just look like Oscar-winning computer graphics next to what you get in Wild Arms, which are just the most kind of dismal-looking monsters ever. And they really improved it in subsequent games, but I love it for trying.
This is a good opportunity to kind of reassess the PlayStation 1's kind of RPG legacy, and I think we'll be able to do that more easily, especially when we see what games end up being included in this collection. There will be 20.
Yes.
But so far, we've only seen the 2 RPGs in addition to, I forget what else has been confirmed.
Flash, Tekken 4, and I forget.
Yeah, so I think that you're a little higher on the PlayStation 1's RPG legacy than I am, Nadia.
I am, and that's something, if you want to go back on the site and read about it, I actually said the PlayStation Classic, I think, is going to have a harder time selling itself compared to like the SNES Classic, because, let's face it, if Sony loads that thing up with 3D games, I don't see anyone having a fun time playing those. Most of those have been revised, revamped, put onto newer systems with better controls. But the RPG legacy of the PlayStation 1 is still fantastic enough that I think that if they lean on it a little heavily, they'll have a pretty good system to sell.
So we got Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 9.
Mm-hmm.
We have, I suppose, Vagrant Story, Final Fantasy Tactics. We go into Symphony of the Night if you want to include that. Tactics Ogre, if you want to include that. What else would you say like really makes the PlayStation 1 a great RPG machine?
I would say Lunar Silver Star Story would be a great addition.
I mean, that was a Saturn game. It started out on the Sega CD.
Yeah, but the PlayStation collection, or I think it was, I know a lot of people who love it. I didn't get to play it myself, but it's one of those games that I look back on very, very fondly.
Yeah, I actually never got a chance to play that one.
It's supposed to be pretty great. And yeah, I've always wanted to get more into Lunar, but I never really had the chance because, as you say, it was really more of a Sega Saturn.
I saw it like 100 times. Actually, a Sega CD, but I saw it like 100 times at the store. And I always meant to buy it, but I never had enough money.
That's too bad. You missed out. I heard, I saw someone on Twitter. I'm not taking this seriously, but I think they were serious. They want to see Legend of Dragoon on there.
Of course, a lot of people want to see Legend of Dragoon on there because a lot of people see it as one of the best RPGs on the PlayStation. But as I said in Slack, I want it to be on. I want it to be in the collection, and I expect it will be because if I recall correctly, yeah, it's either a Sony first party or Sony second party game. And if it ends up being on there, we can all remember together what a bad game it is.
See, I never played it because even like the reviews at the time were like, okay, this game is like some pre-Final Fantasy VII shit. And it was like, what, the year 2000 by that point or something?
Yeah, it was. The graphics were really not good. They obviously put invested most of their resources into they invested most of their resources into the actual Dragoon transformations. Mm. The overworld stuff was better than Final Fantasy VII, but by this time we had Final Fantasy VIII, IX, Vagrant Story, a whole bunch of games that looked really good for the time on the PlayStation, and frankly, Legend of Dragoon just wasn't cutting it. The story wasn't that great. The battle system was just okay. It had kind of this timing-based system that was really annoying to pull off with input delay. Not my favorite, but Breath of Fire yes. 3 is on the PlayStation, and I know that's a favorite of yours.
I would love to see Breath of Fire 3 on there because another thing I mentioned in my article is Sony is going to have to rely on not just on the strength of their RPGs, but also RPGs and games that you can't really get anywhere else. And Breath of Fire 3, you can download it for your Vita, but you're not going to find the original PlayStation game that easily.
Yeah. No, something that occurs to me is that a lot of the best games on the PlayStation 1, yeah, I mean, there was the Square Enix output, but stuff like Lunar and Grandia were perhaps better on other consoles.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Grandia is coming. That's getting a revamp very soon, isn't it?
Yes, it's Grandia 1 and 2 HD. The interesting thing is, I asked them if it was going to be PlayStation or Saturn, and they said kind of neither, because they're basically redoing the original and taking elements of both.
Were the games different on the PlayStation versus Saturn?
Yeah, the PlayStation 1 version had some technical compromises. That was often the case with games on the PlayStation 1, especially when it came to 2D graphics, which I don't believe Grandia was a 2D game, but it definitely... I mean, because the Saturn was so different, porting things over from it was a little different, a little difficult.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
So I suppose I'm going to sound like a broken record when I talk about like what game I would love to see on the PlayStation Classic. But I would love to see Valkyrie Profile.
No, I totally agree with that. I think I mentioned that in my article as well. That is, you want to talk about the premier example of a game you just can't find anywhere else. Yes, that is it.
I mean, yeah, like you said, you can't find it anywhere else, and it's not been on any of the stores. It's a Square Enix property, so I don't know why it couldn't make it over there. And if there was one game that could make me even consider buying a PlayStation Classic, a system which I will undoubtedly have most of the games for already if I want to actually revisit them, it would be that one. Because... Right. Valkyrie Profile is impossible to find. I don't think the iOS port of the PSP game really counts. You can't find it on any of the eShops or PSNs or whatever. And it's always been too bad because while I think that, like many PlayStation games, it doesn't entirely hold up, I do think it's worth revisiting in many respects because it does a lot of really interesting things.
Yeah, that's if you give me a game like that and maybe a few others that are kind of similarly rare, I could see the PlayStation Classic definitely being worth a purchase. Otherwise, as Katie described it, for now, it just looks like another box to play Final Fantasy VII on.
Yeah, I mean, that's what people associate the PlayStation 1 with for the most part, you know, with a handful of other games, maybe Parappa the Rapper.
I wouldn't mind seeing Parappa the Rapper on there as long as they can deal with the lag that kind of plagues the ports to other systems.
The PlayStation had such a flood of games, and so many of them were so bad. I'm looking at, and so many of them are so flawed, like Xenogears. Everybody loves Xenogears, but that game was like half finished.
Yeah, I was thinking, will they include Xenogears on this little PlayStation box? But then I'm like,
I'm betting they will.
I would definitely give it a try if it was on the PlayStation Classic, but then people are going to remember, like, what was it? The entirety of Disc 2 was mostly watching people talk?
It's like 80 hours. That's a long game.
Ain't nobody got time for that. And I'm playing Dragon Quest XI.
When I think of the PlayStation, I think not just of Final Fantasy VII, VIII, IX. I think of, like, Ark the Lad.
Oh, I remember Ark the Lad, yeah.
Star Ocean, the second story, which was not that good a game.
Mm-hmm.
Threads of Fate.
Yeah, all these games have just kind of got lost in the ether.
Yeah. I mean, there was also Chrono Cross, the flawed sequel, the flawed successor to Chrono Trigger.
I would definitely love to see that on the PlayStation Classic. I would probably buy it for Chrono Cross, even though I have Chrono Cross on my Vita. I don't care.
I don't think I would ever play Chrono Cross again. I suppose the only thing that would be interesting to me is now that I've finished Chrono Trigger, it would be kind of interesting to go back and like revisit it.
Yeah, that's prepare to be depressed if you do that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of understand where the basic plot is, especially with the additional stuff that was added to the, I want to say the DS version of the game.
It was, yeah. They tried to link the two with cutscenes and stuff. And the cutscenes were actually really cool, but it still just doesn't really mesh in my mind.
No, it doesn't really mesh in mine either. I think that when it comes to the PlayStation, I mean, Dragon Quest VII is on this thing, and Dragon Quest VII's one of the worst Dragon Quests.
And it was redone, and it was like, it wasn't flawless on the 3DS, but it's definitely a lot better on the 3DS.
If you ever want to give Bob PTSD, just bring up Dragon Quest VII.
Oh, I don't say Dragon Quest VII in his presence. He gets very angry about it.
So when it comes to the PlayStation's RPG legacy, I think that some of it hinges on just how, like a lot of nostalgia, right? People remember how amazing it was at the time, how amazing it was to see those cutscenes and everything. People remember that it was the first time that JRPGs really became popularized here in the U.S. and how all of a sudden stuff like Final Fantasy VII was all the rage, how companies were scrambling to localize their little RPGs that would never have come out here before as quickly as possible, that it was a sea change. As our guides editor, Tom Ori, said, it was the first time that a video games could be kind of cool. Like the PlayStation was cool in a way that the SNES and the Genesis simply were not. When I think of the Genesis, I think Bone Storm.
Thrill ho. No, the Genesis, you're right. For a while, it was very cool to have a Genesis, but kids kind of grew out of that frame of mind very quickly.
Yeah, it was the early 90s, wannabe 14-year-old. We're hardcore. Exactly. Look at all the blood.
Yeah. Mortal Kombat, so much better on the Genesis. Actually, it's better on the SNES. This one has blood.
No, it was better on the Genesis. Come on, Nadia.
I'm not a Mortal Kombat fan either way, so I have no right to talk.
That's the funny thing is that the Genesis did have a lot of things to legitimately recommend it, including sports games, shoot 'em ups, a great arcade legacy, did things very differently from the SNES, and stuff like Phantasy Star was legitimately great, which is why Phantasy Star 4 ended up on our top 25 RPG list. And then the PlayStation came along, and I mean, it changed everything, but just because it changed everything, I think, doesn't necessarily mean that it still holds up today. Like, if I look back at the SNES and I look back at the PlayStation 2, I think that the system, the generations bracketing the PlayStation are, I mean, I would rather play games on either of those systems than almost anything on the PlayStation.
Well, I don't have much nostalgia for the PlayStation 2 because I didn't really get one until very much later in the generation. But I see what you're saying because, frankly, a lot of PS1 games, except for like the sprite-based ones like Symphony of the Night, are just uglier than sin.
They really are. I mean, people were pointing out to me on Twitter that there could be attractive PlayStation 1 games. But I kind of shrug a little bit.
Yeah, like I was saying, I don't know what 3D games Sony plans to put on this thing other than, say, Jumping Flash, which was a great little game in its own right. But do we really want to play Jumping Flash in a post-Mario Odyssey world?
I don't know. I think that as long as they put Final Fantasy VII on this thing, you know, and Wipeout, Parappa the Rapper, and maybe some other games, like, it's going to at least draw attention. Maybe Spyro. Spyro will probably be on it.
Yeah, I was thinking about, like, the audiences that tend to go for these things. Like, it's very much the kind of thing you would see at Walmart and say, oh, I remember Final Fantasy VII. I want that right now. Although the Sony Classic PlayStation Classic is definitely more expensive than the SNES Classic or the NES Classic, to the point that I wonder if it's really the kind of impulse buy that either of those systems are.
Some more PlayStation RPGs. Legend of Mana.
Oh, that game breaks my heart.
Why does it break your heart, Nadia?
Because it's so, so beautiful and so slow and boring.
I saw that like 100 times at Target and I never bought it. And I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, like I remember a Penny Arcade comic where I think it was Legend of Mana was talking to Gabe from the shelf saying, hey, buy me. And Gabe's like, I don't know, I'm Legend of Mana. Everyone says you're really bad. No, buy me.
And he was right.
Yeah, it's just, what a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous game. Oh.
Another game, Legend of Legaia.
Oh, no. I hate that game so bad. That's the game I will forever bear a grudge against that game for. I just remember one scene in that game where, first of all, the hero is named Vaughn, which is, if you live in Toronto, that name will annoy you instantly because Vaughn is the city north of Toronto and their literal slogan is the city above Toronto. And I'm like, you little pricks. So that's number one. I have a hero named Vaughn. So that's strike one. Number two, there's this real naive sort of woman character who asks Vaughn what a pimp is. I'm like, am I reading this right now? Number three,
yes, you are.
I just remember it being a really slow, boring game with an okay soundtrack and an interesting premise that actually just rips off Stephen King's The Mist, like one for one, but hey, may as well rip off from the best like everyone else did at the time. Also, someone broke into my apartment once and they stole like Suikoden 2, Breath of Fire 3, the original Final Fantasy 7, Symphony of the Night without that ugly green best-selling bar on the spine, and they left Legend of Legaia, and I was so mad.
Saga Frontier.
I never played that.
I did.
You like it?
It was very pretty.
Mm-hmm. But
I don't have much else to say about it. It was my first real introduction to kind of hardcore JRPGs, uh-huh. And I don't think I was ready for it.
Yeah, Saga is a little bit on the hardcore side.
Persona.
Oh, now there's an interesting idea. I remember, though, like, just Persona, thinking back and thinking how weird it sounded, but it wasn't until Persona 3 that I really started to hear about Persona, you know what I mean?
I don't think Persona or Valkyrie Profile or games like that will be on the PS1, because even though it has such a rich RPG legacy, mm-hmm. I think that they're not going to want to completely overload it.
Yeah, exactly.
Much like the SNES Classic. SNES Classic had like four or five RPGs of various sizes, and you just had to kind of pick and choose. I would guess that the ones we're going to get are Final Fantasy VII, Wild Arms for some reason, Legend of Dragoon.
Yes.
Because Sony's going to want to include one of their own games and they won't have to negotiate with a third party over it. and Parasite Eve.
Oh, Parasite Eve is an interesting addition. You're right. Wild Arms, by the way, I'm pretty sure Sony published that, so they can just republish it without a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that was published by Sony, I think they're going to snatch up. So I could see that. I could see maybe Vagrant Story or Xenogears making the cuts.
Yeah. Either of those would be...
I would be legitimately shocked if Valkyrie Profile made it on.
No, would I, which is a shame. Because I would love to see it on there. But Vagrant Story would be an interesting addition because that was a hard game. That's a very dense game to kind of understand. And if you do understand it, it's fantastic. But I remember getting very frustrated with it when I was younger.
Tales of Destiny.
Never played it.
A friend of mine friggin' loves Tales of Destiny and would never shut up about it.
I was never a big Tales fan, but it's been a while since I played any of them.
I think that Tales of Destiny is better than a lot of the Tales games that have come since.
Right.
It has an appealing 2D graphical style. It's fun in kind of an anime way, and it's not overbearing like some of the later games.
Right, right. No, I never played it.
Vandal Hearts. Remember Vandal Hearts?
I remember the title, definitely. I also remember some magazine or other saying how it was like a real mature RPG, and I think it was M-rated, actually, now that they think about it.
From Mission 3, which I think that a lot of hardcore mecha fans would love to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was never really into that sort of... Like, I never really followed Front Mission very well. But what about you? You're into mecha. Do you like Front Mission?
Yeah, Front Mission's really good. I love the customization of the actual mechs. And I've always been sad that it never really got a fair shake over here. I think that compared to a lot of mecha... It's actually much more Western-leaning as it resembles Battletech more than, say, Gundam.
Right, right. Interesting.
Brave Fencer Musashi.
Nah, I never played that, but I heard really good things about it. I don't know if it's any good.
I heard that it was uber simple.
Yeah, I think I heard that too, but it's a kind of an action RPG, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so. I wouldn't be surprised if Bushido Blade made it.
Oh, God, that's a blast from the past, isn't it?
This could end up being very Square heavy.
Definitely. I think I remember my husband telling me that he played a lot of that. He's like one of those people who likes Square, but like for all the weird ass non-RPG stuff. Like when I went to visit Square Enix last winter, he was like, ask them if they're going to do another Rad Racer. I'm like, why in God's name would they do another Rad Racer? He's like, just ask them. I never did ask them. He's still mad at me.
Metal Gear Solid will definitely be on it. That. Yeah, I would be legitimately shocked if Metal Gear Solid and Symphony of the Night were not on this.
Yeah, I would too. Definitely, maybe less for Symphony of the Night, but Metal Gear Solid, definitely I'd be shocked.
So, I mean, you can pretty much guess most of the games that are going to be on there. Parappa the Rapper is totally going to be on there. FF7 is totally going to be on there. Metal Gear Solid, Symphony of the Night will be on there. We've already said FF7. I don't expect more than one Final Fantasy. I think Xenogears or Vagrant Story will end up being on there. Parasite Eve has a really good shot. And you know, when I list out these games, I go, yeah, these games are pretty good. Dang, that's a solid collection right there.
Yeah, doesn't sound too bad, especially Symphony of the Night.
What I really want is Super Robot Wars Alpha Gaiden.
I'm afraid that's not going to happen, Kat.
I'm just going to have to mod the PlayStation Classic and put it on there.
You know, I have an SNES Classic and an NES Classic, and I haven't modded either one of them.
Do you think Resident Evil or Resident Evil 2 is more likely to be on there?
Oh, shoot. I would say the original Resident Evil, because Resident Evil 2 is, like, getting a remake soon, and I don't know. Which one is more popular?
I think 2 is more likely. 2 is the more polished, the better.
Yeah.
The better of the two, the more popular. I feel like the series really came to its own with Resident Evil 2.
It doesn't matter so much for Resident Evil 2, but this system doesn't have analog controls, which I think is a real detriment.
That's absolutely true. I had a DualShock with analog controls, but I never used them because I didn't really understand them.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I didn't really understand the concept of analog controls until I picked up an Xbox controller and was horrified.
What about you didn't play like Mario? With Mario 64?
The N64 controller was very different. It had the little thumbstick, and I was still a little confused by that at the time.
Right, right.
I had practically broke it trying to spin Bowser.
I could see that happening. That wasn't the most well-constructed controller, so yeah. Yeah, I could see that happening.
It's one of the worst controllers ever made.
Yeah, the concept is revolutionary, of course, but the... well, look how many people broke their controllers playing Mario Party.
The concept was revolutionary, but it was useful only for like certain games. Like the concept of having exactly one thumbstick, and then the fact that you were holding it in such a way that you were only using half of it.
Yeah.
It's still bizarre to me.
It is very strange. And the D-pad.
The best thing about it was the Z trigger.
Yeah, the Z trigger was amazing. And
which allowed you to lock on to enemies. That was about it.
Yeah,
I'm trying to play GoldenEye on that thing. Oh, are you kidding me?
Thank you. No, it was.
Or you had to look around. You had to stop. I still remember, like, we would be playing. There was the one map that had the two floors, and then you could look down into the bottom floor. And invariably, I'd be running along, and I would see somebody staring down, looking for somebody to come running through, and I would just shoot them as they were staring, because I mean, like, you couldn't just look down really quickly. You had to hold a button and then look down.
Right. Oh man, sounds like my brother playing laser tag with kindergartners.
God, video games in that time, they're so terrible.
Yeah,
oh,
but that
God.
Controller was definitely,
it was a really awkward time, put it that way.
Was definitely engineered for Nintendo's games, and everyone else was like, what about us? And Nintendo's like, meh. They're like, okay, so we'll go to the PlayStation, see ya.
What do you think of the PlayStation Classic? What games, RPGs, do you want to see it? And what do you think of its RPG legacy? I'm sure we'll talk about this more once the PlayStation Classic actually comes out in December. But in the meantime, yeah, send us your thoughts on the show notes or to cat.bailey@usgamer.net. All right, Nadia, let's move on to the top 25 RPGs. All right, continuing on with our top 25 RPG countdown, let's look at number 14 on our list, which is a Pokemon game. See if you can recognize the music track from this game. Yep, number 14 on our list is Pokemon Gold and Silver, which for my money is the best generation of Pokemon, which ironically was also the generation that I missed, Nadia.
Yeah, I have to be fully honest, I didn't really play all of Gold and Silver until I got Soul Silver, but that said, I do very much appreciate what it did for Pokemon. This was the game, if I'm not mistaken, that really established Pokemon as a franchise that was going to stick around for good, because it was just such an improvement over the first game. And the fact that you go back to the original Kanto, that blew a lot of people's minds at the time.
I felt like this was, it felt a little like a last hurrah for the series at the time that it came out, because when Pokemon Gold and Silver came out in 2000, I mean, Pokemania was definitely kind of petering out a little bit. Remember when Pokemon the movie 2000 came out, nobody cared very much. And it was still a thing. It just wasn't as much of a thing, because everybody who had been kind of bonkers for it back in 1998, like yours truly, were kind of out on it by that point, which is why I ended up missing out on Pokemon Gold and Silver until roughly...
I think that's the reason I missed out on it too.
I didn't pick it up until... I think 2003, because that was, and that was actually after Ruby and Sapphire had come out, but I think I picked it up on a road trip. I picked up Crystal on a road trip, and I ended up playing it then.
And how did you like it compared to just going back to it after the third generation? What did you think?
I really liked the music at the time, and I actually really liked the art, and I thought... Mm-hmm. Because at the time, Ruby and Sapphire was actually felt like a bit of a step back compared to Crystal, Gold, and Silver, because Crystal had animated characters where Ruby and Sapphire did not.
That's right, yeah.
Crystal still had really good music. It had certain features that Ruby and Sapphire didn't, actually. For example, Ruby and Sapphire did not have a day and night cycle.
Oh, that's right. And that was like a very big addition for Gold and Silver.
Yeah, it was a really weird thing to not have a day-night cycle in Ruby and Sapphire, because it made it really hard to evolve time-dependent Pokemon. It was a huge pain, actually. It was just funny because there was an eternal clock in Ruby and Sapphire, but it was used for the berries.
How did you, like, evolve, like, time-sensitive Pokemon if there was no night?
To be honest, I don't remember. But I feel like it was still dependent on the clock. It just was a matter of there was no quote-unquote day or night.
Right, yeah, that sucks.
Day and night did not come back until Diamond and Pearl. But Ruby, I had to think about this one long and hard, Nadia, because looking at the whole history of Pokemon, I think Emerald is one of the best Pokemon games ever made. It introduced a battle frontier. It was so replayable. It was so brilliant in so many respects. I really loved a lot of the Pokemon. And more importantly, Ruby and Sapphire was when the Pokemon as we know it today really got started. Whereas Gold and Silver was more the end of an era because it connected directly to Red and Blue. It was a direct follow-up to Red and Blue. You could transfer Pokemon from one to the other. But after Gold and Silver, going into Ruby and Sapphire, there was a definitive cutoff because the systems were totally different in Ruby and Sapphire. They added things like traits, abilities, personalities, and that were not in Gold and Silver. And so there was a hard cut in Ruby and Sapphire. You could not import your collections over to Ruby and Sapphire, which pissed off a lot of the people at the time.
That's right.
So as a consequence, Gold and Silver feels like Gold and Silver, Red and Blue feel like their own thing kind of over in the corner.
No, you're right. Definitely. It's kind of like how the Dragon Quest games all have like these little mini arcs inside of them, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. So, and then I thought, okay, well, what about Platinum? Well, Platinum's a little slow.
I never really played Platinum.
And then I thought really hard about Black 2 and White 2, because people who have listened to this podcast will know that Black 2 and White 2, I've often extolled them as the best Pokemon, or at least the ones that I thought were really in the sweet spot of, I liked the competitive meta game, I liked all of the extras. I thought stuff like the Pokemon World Tournament were just outstanding. I loved a lot of the monsters. I liked Ore. Or not Ore. Whatever the region was called in that one. And then X and Y and Sun and Moon also exist. So, I look at Gold and Silver. I'm like, well, the competitive meta game at the time was pretty slow. But perhaps this is the one.
Yeah. I honestly agree with the choice. I definitely cannot defy it because I think I would have chosen it for the reasons that I already told you. It's funny, though. We mentioned how it was kind of the end of Pokemania at the time, or at least it was petering out. The game came out when I started college, and there was one poor soul who was playing the game, and just like everyone laughed at him and said, no one cares about Pokemon anymore, and I remember he was showing me Gold and Silver, and I was like, wow, this game actually looks really good.
Yeah, and no, it was one of the better looking. It was one of the better looking games on the Game Boy Color. Notably, Gold and Silver did not have animated characters. That was a Crystal thing. Crystal also introduced having a female character.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it did.
But did you know that Pokemon Gold and Silver was in development before Red and Blue even came out here in the U.S.?
Oh, really?
Yep.
Yes. Now that you mentioned it.
Oh, wait. No, I did know that. Duh.
No, the reason I know that now is because I remember when I was watching the anime, going back to it, I saw the first episode, and I saw, like, Ash at the end of that episode sees Ho-Oh, who's...
But that was before they developed the character of Ho-Oh.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They did that in retrospect of, oh, well, let's have that Pokemon, too.
Right. Okay.
But Gold and Silver started development in 1997, which was a year after it came out in Japan. It was meant to follow up from Red and Blue, or Red and Green, I suppose, relatively soon after. It was shown for the first time at Space World in 1997.
Right.
But the Pokemon Game Freak, which was quite small at the time, ended up getting really bogged down by a number of things, including localizing the game for the US and also developing Pokemon Stadium, which Pokemon Stadium is it was its own weird case. I don't even think it had all of the Pokemon in that one.
No, the first version that came out in Japan didn't. I think our version, which was technically Pokemon Stadium 2 in Japan, that one, I think, had all 151.
Yes. So they were being stretched pretty thin. They only had 4 programmers available for Gold and Silver. And that's why it ended up being delayed by quite a bit. And, of course, famously, it was saved by who?
Satoru Iwata.
Yes, he did. Yes.
Yeah, he brought
Satoru Iwata is who we can thank for saving Gold and Silver, at least the Gold and Silver that we knew, and being able to cram Kanto into that tiny cartridge.
God, that guy was amazing.
But Gold and Silver, of course, added 100 Pokemon to the mix of the original bunch, and it shifted over to a new region, Johto, which if Kanto was meant to be Tokyo, then Johto was supposed to be Kyoto.
Yes.
What do you think of the Johto region, Nadia?
I always like Johto region. First of all, I like saying its name. It's a really cool name, Johto. But I was just thinking about my favorite Pokemon from that era, and I'm thinking, you know what? I really like Miltank.
Really?
For some reason, I just always liked Miltank, just this real solid kind of bastard Pokemon who will heal itself. It's a cow.
It is a cow, yes. And its gym really, really tormented a lot of people. I believe it's Whitney.
Whitney, that's it. Whitney's Miltank. Just say that to any, like, Gen Xer, and they'll fall on the floor, shuddering.
Because nobody had to deal with a normal-type gym at that time. Right. And Miltank was so difficult to take down because it had crazy, like, strong defenses for the time. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't have a fighting type, which I think a lot of people discounted fighting types in the original Pokemon Red and Blue.
Definitely.
Because they were so weak to psychic types, and psychic types were extremely strong.
Right.
So you probably didn't catch a fighting type, in which case you would meet Miltank, and Miltank would effortlessly absorb all of your attacks and heal itself. Yeah. And then it would use Rollout, and Rollout would really F up your team.
It sure did. Oh, I wonder if they've nerfed Miltank. They must have by now.
I always liked Johto because it has a really strong Japanese vibe, and it's not embarrassing like the fifth generation region, whose name currently escapes me. Like the one that's like, yeah, cowboys and hot dogs in America. Yeah.
Was that Unova?
That's Unova. Yeah, that's the name of the gym. Or the name of the region. Yeah. Like, Kalos was, that's the worst region.
Kalos and, was, like, it was what? Which game was Kalos? I forget.
Kalos was X and Y. It's the one that's in Europe.
Oh, that one was okay. I like the
fact totally
that
forgettable.
You had a poodle.
No, dude, I don't remember a single thing about the Kalos region except that it had an Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, the professor was kind of hot. I still like Sycamore.
And then Sun and Moon was a good region for the most part, but it was just a chain of islands, ultimately.
Yeah, I really like it.
It's Hawaii. It's pretty.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And Sinnoh, I like Sinnoh. I like Sinnoh better than Hoenn, actually, because it had that... I'm a sucker for any region with snow. Yeah. I'm a sucker for anything with snow.
Because you don't have to live in it anymore.
But Johto was great because it had a lot of kind of history to it, it felt like, much like Kyoto does. Like, it had the burned out tower, right, where Ho-Oh was said to have left the world. And then when the bells tolled, Ho-Oh would return and you could fight it. It had Ash standing on a mountain looking out into the distance, or Red, I suppose, not Ash.
And he doesn't talk, does he? He just, it's kind of creepy, as I recall.
He does not talk. Yeah, and it was also, just artistically, it was a nice departure from Kanto.
Yeah.
And it really made Gold and Silver stand out, and still makes Gold and Silver stand out, I think.
I think there's probably a reason why, and you mentioned a couple of reasons, like Ash standing on a mountain and the burned out tower and all of that. When there's actually a creepypasta called Pokemon Lost Silver that takes place in the Johto region, and that's probably why, because he also had the unknown and the ruins with the unknown in them. And their radio, where you could get the sounds of the unknown. All that was, you're right, it's very distinctive, a little creepy, but unforgettable for sure.
It also had some of the best gym leaders. We already mentioned Whitney. We had Morty, the first ghost type gym leader. But most importantly, we had Claire, who was friggin' awesome.
I'm trying to remember who Claire was. Who did she...
Claire was the dragon type trainer, the eighth trainer, and the disciple of Lance, the dragon trainer. And she, I mean, she was just cool, right? Yeah. I mean, she, when you got to her, she was, it felt like a battle. It felt like a big deal that you had arrived at the end of the road. It more so than almost any other one of the eighth gym leaders. In the original game, you fought the leader of Team Rocket. In this one, you fight the disciple of Claire. And then after that, it was kind of like, yeah, and also this guy is the eighth gym leader or something. Doesn't really matter. So that was kind of the last time that it felt like a big deal when he got to the eighth gym, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
So let's talk a little bit about the Pokemon. So the starters in Gold and Silver, they had a tough time following up from the iconic Charmander, Bulbasaur, and Squirtle. That would be Cyndaquil and Totodile, a little crocodile guy, and Chikorita, which was named the weakest Pokemon or the worst Pokemon starter ever.
Most useless Pokemon by Japan.
Which is sad. I love Meganium. Chikorita was great.
Meganium looks amazing. Chikorita, I remember looking at the design saying, oh God, I don't want that. But then, like, which happens a lot, you see the evolution and you're like, oh man, why didn't I pick that?
Yeah, no, I really like, I like the Chikorita line a lot. And I've always been extremely fond of Meganium. I like it better than Totodile.
If Feraligatr is not my favorite, but Totodile, I love Totodile. And I loved him in the anime too because he was such a little sassy thing.
Feraligatr looks like it belongs in an episode of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
It kind of does. And I'm saying this as someone who absolutely loves Leatherhead. He's my favorite Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles character ever, like in all the series.
I think a lot of people like Cyndaquil the most.
Yeah, Cyndaquil's pretty cool. And was Typhlosion is his name?
Typhlosion is the ultimate evolution.
Yeah, he's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's pretty rad. A lot of people would say that Typhlosion is their favorite. But if you look at kind of the full range, they have a tough time because the red and blue starters, obviously iconic, are in everything, have mega evolutions. And then Ruby and Sapphire, we have a top 25 Pokemon list going up this week. And on that top 25 Pokemon list, all of the Ruby and Sapphire starters make it. Because, I mean, you had Blaziken, which Fighting Fire, everybody loved that one. Mudkip, the Meme Lord.
Mudkip, the Meme Lord. Yes.
And Sceptile, you know, who is just one of the cooler grass types, very distinctive. And they all got Mega Evolution.
Yeah, sorry, Treecko was the first version of that. But Sceptile, I was just thinking about Sceptile because it's interesting. I was looking up the description of Leviathan in the Bible, and he's described as having a tail like a cedar, and that is Sceptile to a T. He literally has a cedar for a tail. I just wondered if that was the inspiration, and I thought that was really cool.
Gold and Silver has better starters than, I don't know, the starters from X and Y or, you know, a Black and White, but... starters are just okay, ultimately.
Well, as you say, they had a really tough act to follow, but they're pretty cool for who they are. I'd give them all hugs.
But the remainder of the Pokedex was, for the most part, really good. Do you remember the first one that kind of appeared that was kind of rumored, Nadia?
Oh, that was Mega Pika Blue, a.k.a. Meryl.
Yes, everybody thought that was going to be like a water-type Pikachu, but in fact, that was not the case.
Yeah, no, we were a little bit off on that one.
Yep. But there were a whole bunch of really good ones that ultimately popped up. Of course, another one that's really famous is Togepi, which was one of the first ones to appear in the anime.
Yeah, that's right. Other than Ho-Oh, of course.
There's Ampharos, the shaved electric sheep.
I love Ampharos. I love Mareep. I just love that whole line. It's one of my favorites.
We had evolutions of some of them, some of the last generation ones, including Umbreon and Espeon.
I love Umbreon.
I think a lot of people love every Umbreon. I think Espeon and Umbreon might be more popular even than the original three Eons.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I like Umbreon a little better than Espeon because Espeon's tail freaks me out. I'm like, what if someone pulls those apart? Yeah.
Why does... Oh, yeah. Okay. There was Wobbuffet.
Oh, he was made famous by the anime as well. Wobbuffet.
There was Scizor, which everybody wanted to be good and was good until finally getting Bullet Punch in Pokemon Platinum two generations later.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Scizor because I love Scyther. I just love Scyther's design, and just changing Scyther's design, it, to me, is just an offense.
It introduced one of the most fearsome pairings in Pokemon history, and that would be Skarmory and Blissey, which would torment people for multiple generations.
Just thinking about that. And here, I love Skarmory's design, one of my favorite Pokemon of all time, but God, combining that with Blissey, what a nightmare.
Some of the Pokemon that were introduced in Gen 2 did not really come into their own until Gen 4. The Mamoswine is a good example of a Pokemon that really didn't become viable until, or even that interesting until Gen 4.
Right.
Gligar did not really become viable or interesting until Gen 4, thanks to when it became Gliscor. But where Pokemon Gold and Silver really stands out, I think, in terms of its Pokedex is its legendaries.
Yes.
Which it has the three dogs, which they're my favorite legendary trio, bar none. I just love them. They're great.
Yeah, they are pretty great, especially Suicune.
Yeah, I got Suicune's definitely my favorite. I got an Entei and a Raikou just recently.
Yeah, I got a Raikou myself in Pokemon Go.
And it also gave the world Tyranitar, thus tormenting people. In the following generation, Tyranitar would get the ability to whip up a sandstorm, which would torment everybody.
Yes. Was Salamence? No, Salamence was Gen 3, wasn't he? Because I love Salamence.
Yes. Okay. Salamence and Metagross were Gen 3.
Okay,
but
Salamence is great.
Lugia and Ho-Oh and Celebi were all great in their own way as well, because Lugia and Ho-Oh were, of course, the cover legendaries. Ho-Oh was the bird, the phoenix-like bird that Ash saw flying overhead. Lugia was, how do you even describe it? It looks really cool. That's what I'll say.
You're right. It's a very interesting design, like kind of a water dinosaur, but also flies with these big, oversized hands. It's a very recognizable design. I always liked Lugia over Ho-Oh myself.
And then, of course, Celebi, which was really hard for Americans to get. If I'm not mistaken, it never even came out here.
I don't remember anything. Like, I think we had a chance to get Mew, never had a chance to get Celebi.
Yeah, we got Mew. It was distributed at events.
Right.
But Celebi was, you had to unlock the event to be able to go catch it in the forest. So the data was on the game, and it was available in Japan, but it was really hard for Americans to get hold of it. I think I've told this story before. When I was in college, I mailed my copy of Ruby to like England or something so that a friend of mine on the internet who had lived in Japan could give me a Japanese Celebi.
Oh, wow. You live dangerously, Kat.
I mean, I didn't have anything on it, and by that time I had transferred everything. But I think that the Gold and Silver Pokedex was the last time that we had the really classic looks that you would associate with Red and Blue. Once you got into Ruby and Sapphire, the artists started to change, and you got some more esoteric designs, I want to say.
Yeah, and also probably just take a minute to give a shout out to the prototype Pokemon from Gold and Silver that showed up at that Space World 1997 show. People just fell in love with all of those, like the screaming Ditto.
Gold and Silver also introduced two new types, which is Psychic and Dark,
Psychic.
Which was in direct response, or not Psychic and Dark, Steel and Dark, which was in direct response to how dominant Psychic types were in Red and Blue, which was their own darn fault, because the only thing that could take down a freaking Psychic type were Bug types, and Bug types didn't have any good attacks.
To make a Bug type survive long enough to actually be able to take on some of the late game Psychics just wasn't happening.
And the only Ghost type attack was Lick. which was very weak. So literally nothing was strong against Psychic.
Yeah, like just trot out the Mewtwo and the battle was over.
So Gold and Silver added a whole bunch of stuff. They had the Steel type and Dark type. Dark type totally nullified Psychic type and was strong against it. Steel type was strong against it, became the premier defensive type. It was so strong that eventually they had to actually nerf it a bit in later generations and make it not as strong against certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And they also wanted to buff up fighting types, so they had fighting be strong against both dark and steel. And actually, they might have even been a little too successful because fighting types became extremely strong thereafter.
Yeah, they did.
Or at least fighting type attacks did,
right.
As did fire type attacks, because fire type was strong against steel attacks. And so that changed the balance of the game for the most part. Mechanically, they added a lot of really interesting things. We already mentioned the day-night cycle. They had, if you would show up, and they also had a clock, so like different events would happen on different days of the week.
That blew my mind. Back in the day.
Oh, this was really cool. So, like, different vendors would only show up on certain days. They, of course, introduced eggs, so you could breed your Pokemon for the first time, which was a big deal. Well, what do you mean, RIP Ditto?
Oh, just everyone, like, breeds everything to poor Ditto. So they get their eggs that they want.
This was before the time of the EVs and the IVs.
Oh,
okay. The way that the stats worked was different. Personalities and traits did not exist, so you didn't have to worry about those being inherited. Though certain Pokemon were still stronger than others when they were hatched. Mm. It was different. But a lot of what we know of as Pokemon today really took shape with Gold and Silver, I would say.
Absolutely. It's a very iconic game. Games.
I would say so. And but of course, I mean, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about how freaking cool. And we always pick best moments when we do these segments. I mean, the best moment had to be the first time you stepped off the train into Kanto, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Although, now that you mentioned, when you mentioned Red standing on that mountain, it kind of, that made me feel a little bit chilly.
I mean, that was a really cool moment as well. But, I mean, the fact that you got to fight all of the gym leaders from the previous games again, that there was that sense of continuity. You could say I'm still chasing the dragon when it comes to Pokemon. I'm still, to this day, I feel like I'm still chasing the thrill of the moment that the first time I stepped off the train and I was in Kanto, but it was a couple years later.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. But I kind of had that moment already, bringing up Dragon Quest again, when I play Dragon Quest 3 and you go from that overworld down to Alufgar from the first game and it's all almost to scale. So, yeah, that's kind of what I know what it feels like, put it that way.
The funny thing is that later games in the series, like the Battle Frontier, I would say is probably better than that. Because the Battle Frontier had really interesting challenges and multiple gym leaders. The Pokemon World Tournament had the thrill of nostalgia. If you play Black and White, Unova, like half the friggin' region is blocked off. And it's bigger when you go there. But the point is, though, it's a surprise. It's the delight. Mm-hmm. It's the realization that, oh, my God, I'm back. I'm back in Kanto, baby.
And I'm going to kill you all.
And then it was really cool to see, like, how things had changed. Like, the fact that the gym on Cinnabar Island was destroyed. To find out that Blue was a gym leader now. Or to wonder whatever happened to Red, or to see that Team Rocket was back in action. It felt like a wonderful extension of the original game, and it really made it. Of course, as a result, Johto was smaller, and you had to be at a much lower level to actually complete the original run of the 8 badges, but
it was
It was perfect. It really was perfect. It was amazing. But, several years later, a very well-received remake came out, Heart Gold and Soul Silver. I would say that Heart Gold and Soul Silver might be the most beloved of all the remakes.
Yeah, I think so. Well, we're talking about like a great remake of a great game. It's hard to go wrong.
Yeah, I always thought it was a little slow myself. And I wasn't all the way down with the soundtrack. I thought the soundtrack I thought the soundtrack on the Game Boy Color was kind of beyond reproach.
Was it the game? It wasn't a Game Boy Color game, though, was it? It was a DS.
The Crystal was a Game Boy Color. Or, sorry. The soundtrack on the Game Boy version of Gold and Silver was beyond reproach.
Okay. Yes.
Whereas it didn't sound as good on the DS. I thought the remake soundtrack wasn't that great, unfortunately.
That's fair. You did have the PokeWalker, though. That's really the precursor to the, to Pokemon Go, I suppose.
I thought I had the best gym theme.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but no, Pokemon Heart Gold and Soul Silver had the PokeWalker, which was, everybody loved the dang PokeWalker.
Everyone loved I remember people putting it in their dryers to try and cheat on me. And of course, that ended exactly how you think it would end.
Yeah, not well. The Pokemon in that thing is dead. It's gone forever.
Yeah, it is cooked.
You killed Pikachu. Speaking of Pikachu, I mean, they had baby versions of Pokemon in this one for the first time.
Oh, that's right, Pichu.
Yes, I got a Pichu, by the way, in Pokemon Go. I was very proud. And not just a Pichu with, like, the sunglasses and the hat.
Oh, I got one of those. I named it Nan because it looks like my grandmother, like, you know, just kind of wearing a sun hat.
All right, so we've talked a lot about Pokemon Go, or Pokemon Gold and Silver. Final thoughts on its legacy?
I think it's the perfect choice for, you know, the inevitable Pokemon selection for our top 25 RPGs because it, as I said before, it really refined Pokemon, and if that was going to be the last hurrah for the series, it would have gone out on a pretty fantastic note, I think.
It was basically perfect. Not only did it bring back Kanto, it added so much. It built on the mechanics so well. It had so many good Pokemon. Yeah. Everybody always says, oh, the original 151 was the best and everything else sucks. But I mean, come on. Look at the stuff like Suicune and Raikou and Celebi and Tyranitar. And they're all pretty iconic in their own right, I would say.
Yeah.
It fleshed out the typings, so it was much better than the original Red and Blue. It built on it in every possible respect. And then also, the fact that it connected to the original game was just friggin' brilliant. The fact that I could bring my monsters from the original Red and Blue over to Gold and Silver, that was mind-blowing at the time. Yeah. With the time machine, that was awesome.
Yeah, it really was. Even like just as an example, like for video games in general, it was one of the most perfect sequels ever made.
Yes, and if you look back on those games, like so many Ruby and Sapphire onward, those games feel iterative. Mm-hmm. Like it's like trying to go back to an MMORPG that's on a different patch version,
right?
To pick up these older games, because each of the games build on the other. But because Gold and Silver was kind of the last hurrah for that variant for that generation, it feels like it's a game that stands on its own and that you can just play.
Right.
Like, yeah. That's, you can buy it on the 3DS. You can buy Gold and Silver on the 3DS along with Red and Blue and everything. I would pick up Crystal myself. That's the best one, I would say. And out of all of the Pokemon games, like, I would have a hard time going back to Black 2 and White 2 as much as I love it. I would have a hard time going back to Emerald. But I would not have a hard time going back to Gold and Silver because it's so perfectly placed in time. So that's number 14 on our top 25 RPG list, Pokemon Gold and Silver. All right, Nadia, as always, we do our mailbag. And last week we interviewed RPG legend Brian Fargo, who had a little bit of a mea culpa on the Nintendo Switch. And we also wondered, where the heck is Final Fantasy VIII on the Nintendo Switch? Because they announced pretty much freaking every other Final Fantasy. And Johnny Boy 507 says, so what do you think? Are Final Fantasy 1 through 6 going to be available a la carte at some point? Maybe a part of the Nintendo Online eventually? Maybe as a collected edition like Mega Man? I could see it as a collected edition, but I think it's more likely that they're a la carte.
Yeah, I could see... I can see either or. I don't care what they give me as long as they don't give me those mobile graphics. You know, the Vaseline ones where, like, Locke looks like he has a rack and just it's just horrible.
Yeah, they're going to do it, though. It'll be a bummer.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say they responded when people like called them out on just putting Chrono Trigger Mobile on Steam. I mean, they've really gone back and made it a game worth buying.
Yeah, they have. But with the Final Fantasy games, they've already got 4, 5, and 6 properly ruined. So you might as well just port those ones.
I think 4 is still okay.
M. Ganai says, hoping for remakes of 5 and 6, hopefully not with the Dissidia designs. Decided those are not my bags. I would not hold your breath for remakes of 5 and 6. Cochambra says, really interesting episode, especially the Brian Fargo interview. I hope both the Bard's Tale 4 and the Switch port of Wasteland 2 sell enough copies so that we can get more games from these guys in the future. I agree. In fact, Brian Fargo said that if he could sell something on the order of like 2 million copies of... I think Bard's Tale 4, he said he was going to try and buy back Interplay.
Do it, man. You can. I believe in you.
Talking about classic RPG brands right there. Metman Master says, my opinion, Final Fantasy VIII not being on Switch has a lot to do with the game not having a pre-existing PS4 or mobile port to work with. Of course, then the question goes to why it simply doesn't have a pre-existing PS4 or mobile port. Well, I think the answer is simply that it's a bigger project to undertake than 7, and Square Enix didn't save the original assets like with 9. Also, FF9 kind of took priority on the port front because it didn't even have one lousy PC version for over a decade. You're not wrong. It was pretty hard to get hold of.
Yeah.
Rider Kicker is pointing his finger at you, Nadia.
Oh, dear.
Nadia doesn't have FF10 on the Vita? This must be amended. Get it on something. Get it. Wait for the Switch version to come out.
I'll get it on the Switch. Don't worry. I'll grab it on the Switch along with Final Fantasy VII.
I've started FF7 about 4 times in the 14 years since I 100%ed it, and I always give up at Shinra HQ until I bought it on PS4. And now I have not progressed past getting out of Midgar. Still have to finish FF9 though. Yeah, I finished FF9. I totally understand that.
Yeah. No, I always finish FF7 when I play it. I get to the third disc, and then I just kind of say, okay, I've had fun. Goodbye.
The River Marquee says, I actually think 8 is one of the worst Final Fantasy games. No, you're breaking my heart. Ooh. As far as the PS1 versus NES RPG goes, it's not even a contest. The PS1 had some amazing RPGs, but most of them have not aged very well, both in terms of graphics and gameplay. Also, for every great RPG on the PS1, there's an even better as well as timeless predecessor on the SNES. I'm not going to disagree with that. And finally, Stuart Shearer, 63, says, FF8 was my favorite game back when I was an angsty teenager. Then I grew up, and upon returning to it on my PSP, found I couldn't really relate to it anymore. I never could relate to it. I just thought it was a fun game. Do I have to relate to everything?
I kind of related to Laguna. Well, I don't know. I'm not as stupid as him, but I liked Laguna. He was always one of my favorite RPG pro tags, and I'm kind of sad that he wasn't the main focus of Final Fantasy VIII.
I always related to Selfie because she was a goof and she liked trains. She wanted to sing the train song. She was very happy.
I remember the train song. Yes, I do.
And now her name is ruined because Selfie.
Oh, God. Oh, right. Yeah, crap. Oh, sorry.
I hate it. Sorry.
I like trains too, though, to be honest with you.
Accessible Guide is a US Gamer podcast. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Follow me on social media at @the_catbot, Nadia at Nadia Oxford. I was on a couple of things recently. I appeared on Kind of Funny Games Daily. If you enjoy listening to that, I was on Jeff Kanata's DLC podcast. You should go check that out. As always, amazing things on the site. Nadia, you wrote about how Dragon Quest XI is an emotional raw, which makes its post game that much sweeter.
Yeah, you haven't played much of Final Fantasy, or at least not enough of Final Fantasy XI for me to really get into it. And of course, it's a massive spoiler, but. Yeah, we've talked in the past about how Dragon Quest goes hard, and Dragon Quest XI goes very hard, but it also gives you, that makes the post-game even better, and I'm not going to, like, kind of say more than that, unless you've played the game, go ahead and read the article, please do, but otherwise come back to it once you finish the game.
Doc Burford wrote about how Destiny 2 Forsaken did Cade 6 dirty, which he feels very emotional about this, so I would go check it out.
Unfortunately, it's all, like, just kind of jibber jabber to me. I love Doc's writing though, so yes, go check it out.
Cade 6 was a really fun character. It was pretty sad. And of course, there's the PlayStation Classic wish list, the games we want for the final 15 spots. Some of the games that we mentioned on this podcast should be appearing in them. So go check that out on the site. In the meantime, we'll be back next week, as always. And until then, for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening. Until next time, happy adventuring.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.